Welcome to the audio podcast of The Table,
a new United Methodist community of faith taking shape at Central UMC in Sacramento, California.
The podcast currently features the messages of Matt Smith and Linda Duhirsu,
with a musical introduction by Anthony Coleman, our director of music.
Thanks for listening. Our scripture passage this morning comes from the book of John, and I'm reading from the first chapter. Next day, Jesus decided to go to Galilee, and he found Philip and said to him, "Follow me." Now, Philip was from Bethsaida, the city of Andrew and Peter. And Philip found Nathanael, and said to him, "We have found him about whom Moses in the law and also the prophets wrote, Jesus, son of Joseph, from Nazareth." Nathanael said to him, "Can anything good come out of Nazareth?" Philip said to him, "Come and see." When Jesus saw Nathanael coming toward him, he said to him, "Here is truly an Israelite in whom there is no deceit." Nathanael asked him, "Where did you get to know me?" Jesus answered, "I saw you under the fig tree before Philip called you." Nathanael replied, "Rabbi, you are the Son of God. You are the King of Israel." Jesus answered, "Do you believe because I told you that I saw you under the fig tree? You will see greater things than these." And he said to him, "Very truly I tell you, you will see heaven opened and the angels of God ascending and descending upon the Son of Man."
Some days I'm a bird, some days I am a song, sometimes I am a storm, some days I'm just plain wrong. There's a still quiet voice, and it sounds a little like mine, saying you're right where you should be, it's just gonna take time. Oh, could you throw me a line? Could you take me in? Yeah, the world's spinning faster now than it ever has been. What used to be sure, up and walked out the door, and the old ways I knew just don't work anymore.
Center in this moment as we move in worship, in prayer. God, may your grace be born anew in our hearts this morning through the words and through the silences, through the music, through the prayer, as we gather around your table. In this time, center us in your deep and abiding love for all this day and every day. Amen. A theologian, his name is Douglas John Hall, and he wrote an autobiography looking back on his life a few years ago, and it's called Bound and Free, A Theologian's Journey. And this is how he starts that book out. "If the first lesson in my autobiographical attempt was to convince me that I'd enjoyed an undeservedly meaningful existence, the second was even more illuminating. It was that I owe such happiness as I have had to one source, namely the sheer grace of God as it is mediated through the lives of other people." John Hall's journey reminds us that God's love comes to us as God did in the flesh of Jesus, in the flesh of folks, ordinary folks, this day. So John Hall looks back on his life, and what he remembers are the folks who sat with him in the pews when he was just starting out as a young boy. He remembers the folks along the way in his workplace who taught him new things about God's love. Most of these folks had no idea that that's what they were teaching him along the way. They were just going about their business, doing what they do, being who they are. He reminds us, though, that that's precisely what shapes us in God's love, the people around us who teach us a way, who support us, encourage us. And then he writes, every one of us plays the role of giver, wittingly or unwittingly, in relation to all whom we meet. And if we know about this ourselves, we may be inspired to pay a good deal more attention than otherwise to the way that we are with one another, the things we say to one another, the deeds we do and leave undone. It's that journey of passing on faith that this story that Linda shared with us from John's Gospel is about this morning. Growing in faith by allowing the lives of others to channel in us the grace of God, and then opening ourselves up that we might share moments of that grace with others whom we encounter. This is how the Gospel of John records it. The next day, Jesus decided to go to Galilee. He found Philip and said to him, "Follow me." Philip was from Bethsaida, the city of Andrew and Peter. Philip found Nathanael and said to him, "We have found Jesus, about him whom Moses and the law and also the prophets wrote, Jesus, son of Joseph from Nazareth." Nathanael said to him, "Can anything good come out of Nazareth?" And Philip said, "Come and see." It happened so quickly in just a couple lines. I want us to hold it again. Jesus finds Philip. Philip finds Nathanael. Can anything good come out of Nazareth? That question, it's harsh that he asks. See, I actually wonder how nervous was Philip when he was approaching Nathanael? See, he's going to Nathanael to say, "We've found the one that all of the prophets tell us is the one. And he's the son of Joseph from Nazareth." I wonder if he was quiet about the second part, or if he said it proudly. And if he did, I wonder what he thought when Nathanael came back to him, "Can anything good come out of Nazareth?" See, I actually think that's a fear that a lot of us have, maybe in this community. I know I've had it in my own past. If I'm going to out myself as a follower of Jesus with folks, I'm prepared for an onslaught of questions.
Yeah.
You can feel the anger rise up in folks when you come out as a follower of Jesus.
Yeah.
I don't think I'm alone in this, yes? Folks get upset. And I think that's maybe what was happening to Nathanael in his day. Can anything good come out of Nazareth? And it took a pretty mature faith, I think, for Philip. I mean, there are some other possible responses, right? Could have said, "Well, let's sit down and talk about this. Well, let's go back through the history of Nazareth. Let's look at the prophets. What leads you to think that? Have you had a hard experience with Nazareth?" I mean, there's so many ways he could have gone, but all he says is, "Come and see." Now, I wonder if that could help some of us share a little more openly. If instead of feeling like we had to defend everything that our life had meant during that time, we could just say, "Come and see." And what if we knew that the person might actually come and see? I don't know, actually, if that would help us share or if that would make us even more fearful. It's exactly what happens, though. And it's through that process that Nathanael starts to grow in faith. Jesus sits down with him, talks with him. And you see an utter transformation in just a few moments. The transformation goes from nothing good can happen from there. See, it was a form of a question, but we all know it was rhetorical. He meant nothing good can come from Nazareth. That was where he started. Maybe you've been that person in your own faith journey. Nothing about that can actually have significance. Nathanael was there. Maybe we resonate with that. He had an encounter, though, and it only happened because Philip said, "Come and see," and he tried it out. In that process, he is utterly transformed as Jesus talks with him in this space. Maybe you've had that experience as well. from deep doubt or uncertainty to there might be something about this. The part of the story, though, that I love the most is this. See, Nathaniel offers, Kevin is with us from seminary, so he'll know that this is a good Orthodox confession of faith. You are the Son of God. You are the King of Israel. And there are many folks around us who would say, that is where you just, that's it. He got it. That was the transformation, correct? The transformation from no possibility that anything good can come from there to you are the Son of God. He's done it. That's the confession. But Jesus doesn't let him stop there, right? Jesus actually asks him a question back. Do you believe this because I have said? Isn't that a profound thing that it's not just the Orthodox confession that Jesus allows to be the moment of transition? Jesus actually pushes further, like, you're going to see greater things than this. You'll see greater things than this. Faith wasn't about just that one moment for Jesus. It was something bigger is going to happen, something you can't even imagine. It's one of the things that I love about our Methodist way of thinking about grace. See, in our world today, grace, people tend to, I'm just going to be blunt, people really do not understand what grace means, and they butcher it. They think that grace is about us. They think it's about me. Grace is about, I didn't have it, and then I do something, and now I have it. Our Methodist tradition that Wesley has shared with us helps us to see grace as an unfolding process. And this is really different than we get in a lot of popular Christianity today. See, grace actually begins with God's love for us. That's where grace starts. That's good news to me, because if it started with me, that's not going to work very well. The good news in God's story of grace is that it starts with God. God's presence in Jesus. John Wesley talked about it this way. Everyone, though born of God in an instant, yet undoubtedly grows by slow degrees. See, I love that because it's not a no grace, now grace, before and after. It's a in grace we're growing by slow degrees. So grace begins with God's love for us. We call that in fancy language, prevenient grace. It's God's love that's already there. When we're the sarcastic ones saying, can anything good come out of Nazareth? God's love is there. And we've all been that, I've been that sarcastic one. In that, we move as God unfolds God's grace in our lives and we're what's called justified. See, we follow this lure toward God and we start to recognize that it's God's love that's calling us to a new way of life. Wesley called that justifying grace. For some folks, that happens in an instant. Wesley was pretty convinced of this, that they can look back on their life and go, that was the moment where I most deeply recognized God's profound love for me. That was the moment. And for others, and Linda would share this, it's been a part of their life all along. And there are moments that they can point to along the way, but God's love kept unfolding in them. There was no one time, it's been all the time. The other piece of this story in terms of the way that Wesley or Methodism invites us to think about grace is that it doesn't end there with that moment or those early experiences of grace. We're called, we're lured toward God's love more deeply and deeply into God's love. And Wesley called that sanctifying grace, or we're being made one with God. And so grace is a process in our lives that we can look back on, much like Hall does in the early piece that I shared, and we see how it unfolds through the people that we meet, the people who gather with us. I think this might be what Jesus meant when he told Nathanael, you'll see greater things than these. That Nathanael, he offers this fairly orthodox understanding, this confession of faith of Jesus, but Jesus reminds him that the lure of God is going to take you even deeper. The confessional statement is powerful, but following Jesus' way is an unfolding that takes 400,000 hours, and bigger things are in store for you. We're going to develop that a lot in our next worship series. When we look at, a lot of us live out in the business world or over at the hospital where we idolize leadership, right? Everybody wants to take the next class to be the next great leader. In the church, too. Almost every time, Linda and I could go to any conference we want to at any given weekend, and almost all of them are about leadership, how to lead. But Jesus calls us to follow. So what do we do when we idolize leadership and Jesus calls us to follow, and how do we hold those two together? We're going to look at that in our next worship series, but for now, for this morning, we're just invited to hold that Jesus calls Philip to follow. He does that by inviting someone else to come and see. That's the process of growing in faith. Last week I shared a selection from Dostoevsky's The Brothers Karamazov. I hope that that reflection invited us to feel what it's like to root our lives in grace. There's a story that I shared, and I'm just going to recap it in a moment, I hope. The story is about this old monk named Zosima. And he remembers a time in his life when he wasn't a monk. He was the farthest thing from a monk. He was in the military. And he'd fallen in love with this young woman. And he went off to fight. And 2 months later, he comes back from the battle. And he finds out that the woman that he had fallen for is actually engaged to be married to another man. And so he does what any good, strong soldier would do. He challenges him to a duel. He challenges him to a duel, and as he gets ready for that duel the night before, he has this battle with his servant, Afanasy. He punches Afanasy over and over and over in the face. And that night, he wakes up in the middle of the night weeping. He looks out on the beauty as the sun's coming up, and he sees in that how his life has come up short. And he wonders, what in the world does God need of him right now? He sees the beauty of God's creation and the depravity of his own life. It's a moment of transformation of grace. And instead of going right away to the duel, he goes to his servant and he says to his servant, please forgive me. And the servant, actually he falls on his knees to kiss the feet of his servant. It's not okay in that cultural view. But that's what he does. I shared that story and I think that there are moments of grace all around in that story. But as you undoubtedly know, Dostoevsky's writing has so much depth, so many layers to it. The story stayed with me this week, and I was reading some other commentaries, and it fits with our image, not just of rooted in grace, but of growing in faith as well. See, I tried to claim that last week, that was the moment of grace that turned this person's life in a new direction. He went from the military to making a mockery of the duel and then on to become a religious person. But what I found as well is that his story didn't begin there, as you probably already know. His story began years and years ago as a young boy when he was with his brother, and his brother said these words to him, "Am I worth it?" It just seems like a simple phrase, am I worth it? But it stuck with him. His brother died, and it was that phrase, am I worth it, that Afanasy, the servant, says to him when he's on his knees kissing the servant's feet. That's the phrase that he hears. And so it floods him with memories of the brother that he loved. It takes him back to that childhood. So then we're left to ask, where did the grace actually begin in this person's life? Was he transformed at that moment when he looked out the window or when he knelt at the feet of his servant? Or was he transformed when he was a child and that just stayed with him over time? One writer that I followed this week talked about it as a seed that was planted in him as a child. And it went dormant. It died. And then it was born again in that moment when he was on his knees with his servant. I think that's how grace works in our lives. That's what it looks like to grow in faith. We don't always know that we're growing when we're in the midst of it. Sometimes folks plant seeds in our lives and they go deep inside of us. You might think that they die, but they come back years, decades, a whole lifetime later to make us new. And it's the same thing, much like Philip has that seed planted in him, and then he goes to Nathanael. The same thing in this story. Zosima passes this on, and then it's passed on as well again. And I think that Dostoevsky wants the reader to actually take the seed in and say it out loud themselves, am I worth it? So that it gets etched into our memories as well. That's how grace unfolds from person to person, from flesh to flesh, as we live in God's love throughout our lives. See, grace was taking root before they knew it. Grace was that liberating moment of new life, but it had been planted there long, long ago, and it makes me wonder, what were the seeds that were planted in you long, long ago? Who were the folks like Philip that invited you to come and see? And maybe sarcastically you said, can anything good happen there? And you ran away from it. Who are the folks that you're around now that you're planting those seeds deep within? You may not be aware of it. This weekend, we gather to remember the life of Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King. And I hear oftentimes in our kitchen tables, when we talk about grace and we talk about growing in grace, that folks who've been raised in the church and have been raised with an experience of God's love in their family and other places, that we often get envious when we see folks whose lives have a radical conversion experience, right? Like it must be that Zosima's life was all bad and then it became beautiful. And we look at someone who can say, that was the moment of grace. And we just find ourselves deeply moved by that. So it's powerful for me to think about Reverend Dr. King this day and how he grew in faith. Because like many of us, his story is one that's been unfolding over time. And that seed of grace was planted in him long, long ago. So I want to take us in to close just with a few images from Dr. King on this day. King described himself as the son of a Baptist preacher, the grandson of a Baptist preacher, and the great-grandson of a Baptist preacher. The church is my life, and I have given my life to the church. So as we remember Dr. King this weekend, I want us to hold for just a moment. Who were some of the folks in his life that were planting those early seeds? Who were some of the folks that invited him to know God's grace, to come and see? To be sure, no one has communicated the idea of the American dream with greater moral and oratorical power, with greater religious and political imagination than Martin Luther King Jr. So who invited him? What seeds of grace were in his life? James Cone writes about Martin Luther King in this way. At the age of 5, Martin joined the church. As he later said, not out of any dynamic conviction, but out of a childhood desire to keep up with my sister. There's some humanity in that, yes? I'm 5 and I want to keep up with my sister. Yet at Ebenezer, the spirituality of the black church was planted deeply in his being, and it grew to become the sustaining force in his life. King himself recorded he was writing in seminary, and he's writing an autobiography, as seminary students almost always have to do that first semester. And this is how he wrote about it while he was at Kozer Theological Seminary. It's quite easy for me to think of a God of love, mainly because I grew up in a family where love was central and where lovely relationships were ever present. It's quite easy for me to think of the universe as basically friendly, mainly because of my uplifting hereditary and environmental circumstances. It's quite easy for me to lean more towards optimism than pessimism about human nature, mainly because of my childhood experiences. It's impossible to get at the root of one's religious attitudes without taking into account the psychological and historical factors that play upon the individual. So King experienced his call to ministry when he was 18 years old. He had been rooted in a life of love and grace in the black church of a father, a grandfather, of a mother, and family that surrounded him in love. It's all that he knew in that place. And then he went off to school. He went to seminary and then to Boston University, and he saw both sides of what white racism causes and does to the world. He saw white folks who helped him think in new ways about social change, and he encountered white folks who would not allow him to sit next to them. So that optimism was shaded with pessimism. And he started to be introduced to Protestant liberal theology, to Gandhi. And in these moves, he started to see that a theoretical framework of nonviolence could lead black people in this country to freedom. See, King also had a struggle with the church of his childhood. He called it emotionalism. And he was actually embarrassed at times about the emotional vigor of the church that he'd grown up with. He wanted to run far, far away from that. And you could say he did run far away from that as he went off to Boston University. And yet in that space where he found Reinhold Niebuhr and other theologians, they planted seeds in his life, he also found a new love for the roots that were born in him as a child. And it was those two coming together that helped create the grace that made Dr. King's vision so powerful, so prophetic, so beautiful. See, eventually he would leave the books behind to go back to the South. But I think you could also say the books never left him behind. That his childhood and his education were woven together. Those seeds shaped the man that changed our community, our lives. King says it this way: I choose to identify with the underprivileged. I choose to identify with the poor. I choose to give my life for the hungry. I choose to live for and with those who find themselves seeing life as a long and desolate corridor with no exit signs. This is the way I'm going. If it means suffering a little bit, I'm going that way. If it means sacrificing, I'm going that way. If it means dying for them, I'm going that way. Because I heard the voice saying, do something for others. And that still small voice was planted in him long, long ago by his mother and grandmother, by his father and grandfather, by the folks in his church who looked at him and said, come and see. And for a long time, he actually looked back and said, nothing good can come out of that. And yet that seed stayed in him, and it grew, and it transformed. It changed his life, and his life has changed ours. So many will ask us, can anything good come from Nazareth? And our question as we grow in faith is, how will we respond? How will we respond? Come and see. The table is set. Come and see.
Nothing like a dream.